Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I'm doing great today, Tim. I'm super excited about this episode because it is a bit of a deviation from what we typically produce, and it's a very personal glimpse into something that you've been looking into for years. And you put this together. I haven't heard it. I know some of the elements of it, and I can't wait to listen to it. And I love the fact that this is being released on Thanksgiving and the day before Thanksgiving. So if you do hear this during this time and you're with your family, just take a moment and appreciate what you got going on around you. This is a fantastic story. I'm going to stop talking and I'll pass it over to you now.
Okay, thanks a lot. Yeah, this is kind of a holiday special, I guess. We're going to be releasing it on both of our podcasts, Crawl Space and Missing Tomorrow on Thanksgiving. My great uncle Tom Polleri is technically missing. We'll get into it in the story. I'm joined by several people in this episode. One of them is my father, Frank Polleri. A couple other people who have helped a lot. That's Dave Nichols and Judy Knopp. You'll hear from them a little bit later. And two great voice actors, Sarah Sheckles and G. Larry Butler, help lend their voices to this episode. So I'm really excited to share this. I hope everyone really enjoys it.
And before we get to that, Tim, maybe we should talk about our subscription service real quick.
Yeah, I think we should. If you'd like an ad-free version of Crawl Space, you can subscribe via Apple Podcasts for just $2.99 a month for the ad-free version. But if you want the ad-free version and our bonus show, you can go to crawlspace.supportingcast.fm and you can subscribe there.
And if one wanted to follow us on social media, where would one go?
Thanks for asking, Lance. You can find us at Crawl Space Podcast or Crawl Space Pod on social media. We're going to break quick for commercial here, and we'll be right back with the episode.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This story is unlike most that we cover on this show. And that's because this one is about my great-uncle, Thomas Stephen Polleri, a man I never met, but still feel connected to at times. Our names are only separated by one letter. He's Tom, and I'm Tim, and we both share the same last name. There aren't many Polleris out there. There are some Tom Polleris in the Boston area who I am also related to, and they were named after the original Tom Polleri that you're about to hear about. This is a true story about a mostly unknown American hero in my family. And I'd like to try and help change the unknown part. Tom was born on April 15, 1922 in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He was the fourth of seven kids that Angelina and James Polleri had. Both of Tom's parents were born in Naples, Italy, before the turn of the century. They were married and already had two children before leaving Italy for America on the SS Canopic, really just days after the official end of World War I. I wondered if their decision to leave Italy was because of the war and political unrest, to keep their family safe. But I suppose if that's true, it would be darkly ironic. They were a working-class family like so many other big immigrant families living in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the time. There was Mom Angelina, Dad James, older brother Pasquale, who went by Pat, Josephine, Rose, Tom was fourth in line, then came my grandfather Francis Rudolph. Next was Mary, then Elvira, who went by Honey. We'll be hearing a letter from Honey later. Growing up, Tom was an excellent three-sport athlete. Fast as lightning, he excelled at baseball, football, and basketball. And after high school, Tom and his older brother Pasquale were working in a candy store to help support the family. Tom was 19 years old when suddenly his life and the lives of millions of Americans changed on one fateful day. On December 7, 1941, Japanese fighter jets surprised U.S. forces at Pearl Harbor Naval Base in Hawaii. They bombed the base and killed over 2,400 American service members and 68 civilians. The United States had officially been pulled into World War II, where up until this point, we'd resisted. Now, I don't know this to be true, but I think that 19-year-old Tommy was so pissed off about the attack on Pearl Harbor that he enlisted in the Marines that same month, because just 31 days later, on January 8, 1942, he was already reporting for duty. It was a scary time for young kids like Tom, who went from doing homework and playing basketball in high school to firing guns and running for their lives on battlefields across the globe. Tom's family didn't want him to go. My grandfather, Frank Polari, was just 16 years old when his big brother deployed. I can hardly imagine how emotional that goodbye scene was. The family knew Tom was being sent to war and that there was a chance they'd never see him again. I picture my 16-year-old grandfather giving his older brother a bear hug. Sister Honey mentions their family goodbye in a 1979 letter to the U.S. government.
I last saw my brother January 6, 1942. Within a few days, on January 25th, I would have been 12 years old. He promised me he'd be back for my birthday. But he couldn't make it. I remember calling him and crying at the window. He blew kisses to me and Mom and waved. He yelled back, "I'll see you soon." We didn't, but he couldn't help it. It is 37 years now, and I still remember.
Tom was first sent to basic training at Camp Lejeune in Jacksonville, North Carolina. And I learned from my new friend Judy, tell you about her later, that Tom took a train across the country to San Diego, California, and he eventually left on a transport ship that was a converted ocean liner nicknamed the Wacky Mac that left from San Francisco and went out right under the Golden Gate Bridge. I wondered where Tom was when he turned 20 on April 15th, 1942. Judy told me that he likely celebrated his 20th birthday in New Zealand or Australia before actually going to battle. Well, I just hope he had a good time. If when I turned 20 was any indication of what Tom was like when he turned 20, well, it would have been a good party. Tom was then sent to the Solomon Islands. The Solomon Islands are these small isles off the coast of Papua New Guinea and Australia. It looks positively beautiful in the limited photos I've seen on the internet, but I've never been. And back when Tom was there in 1942, it looked a lot different. It sounded a lot different. When I think of the Solomon Islands today, I think it sounds windy with a side of mosquito buzz. But as a podcaster, I'm always thinking about audio quality. And back in 1942, when Tom was there, there was also gunfire, bombs, and screams. Guadalcanal Island is where Tom ended up. And today in 2022, you can purchase guadalcanal.com for only $6,500. It seems like the island's official site, if it has one at all. If you're a big history or World War II buff, you may have heard of the Battle of Guadalcanal. It was featured in the James Jones book and Terrence Malick film The Thin Red Line, and more recently in the TV series The Pacific, produced by Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks. It was apparently one of the turning points in the war, and the U.S. had all of their military branches on the island during this bloody battle that went from August of 1942 to February of 43. Now, I've learned a lot about the Battle of Guadalcanal since starting this deep dive into Tom. And I understand the main objective of this tug of war over this island was an airstrip, later named Henderson Field. And it became an important launching point for the Allies during their time in the South Pacific. And while doing research about Guadalcanal at that time, I found this incredible video on YouTube. It's called USS Wasp CV-7, Burning and Sinking, Very Rare Footage, 1942. This aircraft carrier was sunk by three Japanese torpedoes on September 15, 1942, just off the coast of Guadalcanal. And I have to wonder if Tom saw it. I mean, someone filmed it sinking. There were probably hundreds of soldiers watching it sink. A bunch more jumping off the carrier, maybe swimming to the beach. I can't imagine what watching that aircraft carrier sink did to the hope of the service members on that island. And then it occurred to me, could I be watching the same thing today on YouTube from the comfort of my home office that Tom saw from that island in 1942? And then I realized, no, I know he didn't see this. Because a couple of nights earlier, on September 13th, 1942, Tom and his battalion, the 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines Division, was guarding a throughway called the Overland Trail. Down the trail led to their entire headquarters and Henderson Field, which was the airstrip mentioned earlier that was so important during the war. Tom and 5 others volunteered to protect this trail overnight. Lieutenant Joseph Terzi, Private First Class Polari, Mixter, Lawrence, Jabo, and McDermott were the 6 men who set up a listening post to protect the trail that night armed with Thompson submachine guns. And they must have been pretty quiet. They seemed to be expecting to see the Japanese. Major Eiji Mizuno's Kuma Battalion was already a day late when they arrived that night. And this is the description that Private First Class Leo McDermott gave in Jason Abadie's book, Battle at the Overland Trail.
6 of us ran into a company of Japs. Polari, Mixter, Lawrence, Jabo, Joe Terzi, and myself. Heard them coming and shot hell out of some of them. They tossed about 20 or 30 grenades at us, and we withdrew to the Ailu River. We stayed in the river under an overhanging bank while the Japs beat along both banks, shooting and screaming. We stayed in the river about 3 hours, damn near froze to death. Then we climbed up the bank and stayed there till dawn. That night was the worst I've ever spent. It's only a miracle that I'm here writing this today. Mixter and Jabo came back about 4 days later. Lawrence had made it back to our lines the night the firefight started. The lieutenant and I came back the morning after. Polari didn't come back at all. Leaving Tom on this island, he died there that night. We didn't find out till 4 days later. Tom was a good friend and a swell guy.
That passage from Jason Abadie's book is one of the only descriptions of that night that you can find anywhere. But if you go to valor.militarytimes.com/hero/205002, you will find some more information about that night. You'll also find that Private First Class Thomas S. Polari was posthumously awarded the Silver Star for conspicuous gallantry and intrepidity in action in connection with operations against the enemy at Guadalcanal on the 13th and 14th of September 1942. Private First Class Polari was manning a machine gun for the all-volunteer forward element listening post when a Japanese battalion initiated a full-scale assault to overrun the Marine control of Henderson Field. In the ensuing heavy firefight, Private First Class Polari heroically remained at his station to cover the ordered withdrawal to the unit perimeter. Due to the lethal fire he provided against the enveloping enemy, the other members of the post were able to withdraw. The Japanese surge was checked, and the defensive positions were altered to maximum readiness. Private First Class Polari's actions ultimately cost him his life, but helped save the lives of other members of his unit and also helped the 11th Marines to repulse the Japanese attack. By his initiative, courageous actions, and complete dedication to duty, Private First Class Polari reflected great credit upon himself and upheld the highest traditions of the Marine Corps and the United States Naval Service. Naturally, my family was devastated when they learned of Tom's death, and there was an infinite sadness that took over the family. I can't begin to understand what that must have felt like, but I try. I actually try every day while covering missing persons on one of my podcasts called Missing. This one time, not even that long ago, after we stopped recording with a mom of a missing young woman, we thanked her, she thanked us, and turned off her Zoom, or at least she thought she did. What my friend and co-host Lance Reinsterner and I saw was a woman who had kept it all in for an hour just to speak to us about her missing child. We now saw visual evidence of how hard that was for her to do. But she delayed that pain and pushed it down for an hour because it could possibly help find her kid. When she realized she was still on the Zoom, she quickly and instinctively shut it off, almost like she was embarrassed to show us that hurt. But not after letting out what I can only describe as a groan, a sound of deep pain. We've spoken to a lot of family and friends of missing people over the years, and a loss like that leaves a hole in their lives that can't be filled. Angelina and James got divorced, which was kind of rare for that time. James died a few years before my father was born, so he never met his grandfather from Italy. But he had this to say.
My siblings and I weren't overly close with our grandmother Angelina. The only thing we really knew was she was a good cook, and she was divorced, and she had a bunch of kids. Other than that, we didn't know that much about her.
What did you hear about her divorce to James?
James was, I guess he had a drinking problem. That's really the only thing that I know.
Do you know, was he an alcoholic or a big drinker before Tom went missing?
You know, that's a great question. I know less about him than I do my grandmother, Angelina. So I'm not sure. I mean, there were, you know, a couple of rumors, but don't have a lot of info about James or Angelina.
I know Tom's mom, Angelina, missed him dearly. She dictated a paragraph to Honey in their 1979 letter to the U.S. government.
I want my son Tommy to come home. I cannot rest till we have him here. I dream of Tommy all the time. He don't want to be where he is. He want to come home. We must find a way to bring him home now. He is my boy. Tell them I wanted my boy when they told me I could send him. Then I get another letter. They tell me the Japanese bombed where the graves were, and they said it would be hard to find him. I want my boy, and I must find him. I cannot rest till we bring him home.
My grandfather didn't talk about his brother much. I was lucky enough to have my grandfather in my life for 24 years, and I never heard him talk about Tom. He was great to me, my sister, parents, cousins. We never witnessed that kind of sadness in him. Was it there? Did time help heal that hole that Tom left in him? Maybe having kids and grandkids did. I wondered. I needed to know from my dad if his father ever talked about Tom. Did he ever break down in front of his family? I asked him.
You know, my father was very tight-lipped about anything that happened in the war. I can probably name 4 or 5 different things that he mentioned about that particular time or his brother Tom. It was pretty much never spoken.
So your father basically never mentioned his missing brother Tom to you or your siblings?
Not really, other than, you know, at the dedication for, you know, Thomas Polari Square in Cambridge, he mentioned that was his older brother, and he passed. And other than that, he never really, really mentioned him.
Were you at the dedication for the square?
I was, yeah.
Thomas Polari Square exists right near where the family was raised, at the corner of 2nd Street and Cambridge Street in Cambridge, Massachusetts. If you're familiar with Boston or Cambridge, this is very close to the Lechmere train station, but you could easily miss this sign if you weren't looking for it. It stands about 10 feet high. The sign is black with a gold star on it. It reads Thomas S. Polari Square, Private United States Marine Corps, World War II. Born April 15th, 1922, killed in action September 7th, 1942. Guadalcanal, Solomon Islands.
It was a pretty proud moment. It was very, very nice. It was a short ceremony. I think the mayor, I forget, maybe Senator Kennedy might have been there, or some politicians were definitely there, but I don't remember which ones.
Did Papa get emotional either that time or at the dedication in the early 2000s?
He got emotional at both, at least somewhat. You know, he was, you know, your grandfather was a pretty stoic guy. He didn't show all that much emotion, especially if it was tearful emotion. But I do think that he learned some things at the dedication. I don't know that he knew the full scope of what you know Tom had done to protect the rest of his platoon.
You mentioned Papa's sisters. Did they ever talk about Tommy, or did you ever see the impact of his loss on them?
Not so much. I do know that, you know, they still carried that loss up until, you know, I was an adult, started my own family and all. Especially the youngest sister, you know, we called her Honey, and her name was actually Elvira, and they called her Honey. She was extremely emotional about everything. She was that type of person, and every time she talked of her brothers, she always mentioned Tom, and a tear would come to her eye. So I got more information out of my aunts than my dad, you know, ever.
And I'd always heard this rumor that my grandfather lied about his age to enlist in the service to sort of avenge his brother Tom's death. Although I can't find documented proof, there are some hints on Ancestry.com, and I asked my dad.
And my father was so distraught and ticked off, he went down and joined the Marines. But the problem was, he wasn't of legal age to join the Marines or join any branch of service. So he forged his paperwork in order to go and enlist in the Marines, which is the same branch that Tom was part of. And the story that I heard was, my father was so angry at the enemy that he wanted to go and avenge his death. It was almost like a Marvel DC comic movie motivation, but he forged the paperwork to make him that minimum age so that they wouldn't even question it and they would accept him.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Gather round, friend, and join me by the fire. I have a secret to share. When I was a child, I lived with my grandma. She allowed me to watch Unsolved Mysteries. Fast forward to 2008, my freshman year of college. A series of armed robberies on campus escalated into a serial rapist's reign of terror. That's when I created my first crime podcast. In January 2014, I picked up the podcast again from my college roommate who fell for an underage girl online, to the chilling story of a murdered nun in 1969 Baltimore, and in the Throwaway series, I share my own journey of overcoming homelessness and how that experience led me to unmask a serial killer and identify three of his Jane Doe victims. This is Foul Play Crime Series, where the stories are real and the truth is waiting to be discovered.
Rex Sherman is a demon that walks among us, a predator that ruined families.
The LISK, Long Island Serial Killer podcast, was shocked when the news broke of Rex Huerman's arrest. After more than a decade of searching, law enforcement officials had finally pieced together enough evidence to bring formal charges against Rex Huerman. Initially charged with three murders, Huerman is now officially charged with all four deaths in the Gilgo 4 case. I'm your host, Chris Moss, and the LISK podcast will be releasing new episodes with interviews and fresh insight on the case as Rex Huerman awaits trial in Long Island. While we are relieved by the arrest, the LISK podcast team will be working hard to share new developments and perspectives as we get them. So please keep your eyes and ears out for new episodes, and if you haven't already, please listen to seasons 1 and 2 of LISK, Long Island Serial Killer, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program. So that brings us to October 3rd, 2017, when I received a Facebook message from a familiar name. Not a familiar person, but a name that was familiar because I grew up right across the street from not one, but two men named this exact same thing. And at this point in my life, I had been working on the Disappearance of Maura Murray case and docuseries from Oxygen Network. In fact, it had just aired the second of its six parts a few days earlier. So I opened this message, and it wasn't from one of my old neighbors. It was a different guy who went by the same name. And his message was curious. He introduced himself and basically just asked me to confirm that I was who he thought I was. Because of the docuseries, we had been experiencing more emails and theories than ever before about the Maura Murray disappearance case. The online trolls in that case are notorious, and in my head I remember not replying to him for weeks, but in reality, I wrote him back in 2 minutes. Which is a sign of the times, I guess, to me at least, because I'm never on Facebook Messenger anymore. So we agreed to have a phone conversation, and we spoke the next evening. He told me all about the Honor Flight Network, and he said that he wanted to fly a flag over the Capitol building in honor of my great Uncle Tom. I recently spoke with Dave Nichols for this podcast, and I asked him about it.
I had a flag flown, and I sent them the information about Thomas. And actually, my mother had gotten so deeply involved in this story, that's how I kind of found out about it. Thomas is her adoptive veteran and kind of a guardian angel in a way. I had it flown to send to her, so it came, you know, folded in a triangle as it does, and with a certificate saying this flag was flown over the U.S. Capitol on such and such a date in honor of Thomas Pillery. It's kind of a neat thing to do to honor someone.
Now, before we recorded, I thought that what Dave had done for Tom about the flag getting flown over the Capitol was actually a part of his work at Honor Flight, but I was wrong.
So Honor Flight, we're a national nonprofit. Our mission is to bring World War II, Korean, and Vietnam veterans from all over the country at no cost to the veteran to D.C. to be honored at their memorials. Our two co-founders had the realization that a lot of these veterans, even back then, can't travel or didn't have the means to travel and would never get to see their memorial. So we started out taking World War II veterans. The first flight was six Cessnas with two veterans on each, and they came from Ohio. And since then, we've had hubs in different parts of the country who charter a 747 and fill it. So it's gotten very big. But so that's our mission, to get as many to see their memorials that they dedicated their lives and made such a high sacrifice for.
So at the end of it, all he really wanted from me was a photograph of Thomas Pillery for his mom. And guess what? I didn't have one. So determined to find a photo of Tom, Dave wisely relied on his contacts. He put me in contact with a Katie from History Flight, not to be confused with Honor Flight. Dave and Katie met during the funeral service for a Tuskegee Airman who was lost during World War II, then found and identified. And they were apparently talking about Tom Pillery, which led him to put me in contact with Katie. Katie then put me in touch with U.S. Marine Corps headquarters in Quantico, Virginia, specifically the Prisoner of War Missing in Action office. I was also put in touch with someone from the DNA Family Outreach Program, and for the first time I wondered, hey, what are the chances Tom could actually be recovered? They asked for my DNA, and I told them of course I'll send it in. What if? How wild would that be? But unfortunately, as I know all too well being in the true crime space, sometimes DNA results take forever. Things are getting better though. Just check out DNASolves.com for evidence of that. So after I sent my DNA to the government to hopefully try and make a match, the government actually sent me Tom's entire military records, which includes that letter from Honey and my great-grandmother, as well as one very faint photocopy of a photograph of Tom. And you can barely make him out. But if this photocopy exists, then there's gotta be a real copy somewhere, right? I think this is probably a good time to play the entire letter from my great-aunt Honey and my great-grandmother Angelina. To call the moment I read this letter emotional is probably an understatement. It was surreal. Reading the words from my great aunt and great grandmother. They were desperate to try to locate Tom to bring him back to Cambridge, Mass. And this letter from Honey and Angelina is actually the epilogue in a book called Leaving Mac Behind, The Lost Marines of Guadalcanal by Jeffrey Rocker.
July 17th, 1979. Dear General, Sir, I am writing this letter to you today in the hopes you may be able to help us. First of all, I am writing for myself. My feelings are very deep and very concerning. I am worried about my mom. Her health is declining. She is, or rather will be, 83 years old, August 6th, 79. She is a Gold Star mother and was dependent on my brother Tommy, as there were still four of us whom he supported, plus Mom made five. I last saw my brother January 6th, 1942. Within a few days, on January 25th, I would have been 12 years old. He promised me he'd be back for my birthday. But he couldn't make it. I remember calling him and crying at the window. He blew kisses to me and Mom and waved. He yelled back, "I'll see you soon." We didn't, but he couldn't help it. It is 37 years now, and I still remember. Oh, yes, he did come back once and was called back and his leave was canceled. He left us again, but this time, he never came back. I have had many birthdays since, but always I remember Tommy in my prayers. If only he could come home, I would feel very happy knowing he is where he belongs. I have to think that way, otherwise I could become very sick. Here I am trying to nurse Mom, who cries constantly for Tommy. As I said, Mom will be 83 years old. Now, I am writing for her.
I want my son Tommy to come home. I cannot rest till we have him here. I dream of Tommy all the time. He don't want to be where he is. He want to come home. We must find a way to bring him home now. He is my boy. Tell them I wanted my boy when they told me I could send him. Then I get another letter. They tell me the Japanese bombed where the graves were, and they said it would be hard to find him. I want my boy, and I must find him. I cannot rest till we bring him home.
My sister's four and brother's three, those of us, the total seven plus me and Tommy was eight. We lost a sister, so now there are six of us left, oldest being in order, Patsy, Josie, Rosie, Frankie, Mary, and me, Elvira. We all agree to be able to give Mom peace of mind, to do what we can to bring Tommy home. More than a month now, we wrote to Ted Kennedy and asked him to please help us. I sent him copies of all the papers we have, all that I could find pertaining to our loss. Time is very important. Every day is a bonus as far as Mom is concerned. Could you please advise us on how to get a quick reply? We realize that we are not the only ones needing help, but someone, somewhere, should be able to tell us something. If you need any more information, please let us know. We had another family meeting the day before yesterday. We all agreed as to what to expect. We know after 37 years. I don't want to go into that. But if it will put my mom at ease, we must hide our thoughts and our feelings for her sake. We must believe as she believes. It is important now. You see, sir, I don't think any of us was really convinced Tommy was really dead. God help us. God help him. Please help us. Tell me what to do next. Only please make us hear from you soon. We plan to have a very quick, very quaint family thing in the servicemen's section of Cambridge Cemetery. My mom wants us to get her a place as close to where Tommy will be. It is sad. My mom lives with my husband and me. She cannot do for herself. She needs care. We have done it this last 8 years, and she is not better. She is worse, and every day counts. She cries in the night. So we have to do this. If you could call her and tell her you are doing what you can, it would help. Sincerely, Mrs. George Paula, for Mom, Mrs. Angelina Polari.
I was shocked to read that they still weren't sure if Tom was alive or not. I think deep down they probably knew he wasn't, but they were still holding out hope. To hear how badly they wanted him to be buried in Cambridge is simply remarkable to me. I mean, that letter was sent 37 years after Tommy's disappearance. Angelina was getting old and she passed away a few years later. She never saw Tom again after he left in 1942. And it's clear that the family never found closure. The government sent recovery missions in 1947 and 1949 to try and find Tom, as well as other missing soldiers and Marines. To my knowledge, they weren't successful in locating him, and I'm reading from his official file now. This one is dated May 23, 1947. Private First Class Thomas Stephen Polari, 354727, was officially reported killed in action on the 17th of September, 1942, at Guadalcanal, British Solomon Islands. Entry in service record book shows buried in the field on the 17th of September, 1942. And then in a letter dated April 26, 1949, it goes on to say that exact details are not given, and no further information is available. And in the file, it has coordinates. The island was searched from map coordinates 159 degrees 55 minutes east and 9 degrees 25 minutes south to 160 degrees 20 minutes east and 9 degrees 35 minutes south. It goes on. After careful consideration of all the facts involved, the board unanimously resolved that the subject decedent be declared non-recoverable. And then there's another letter I have from the 19th of September in 1949 that again says the remains of the subject have been declared non-recoverable by special boards convened in the field and in the office of the Quartermaster General. So it seems like the government tried to locate Tom, but weren't able to. And I wasn't even able to locate a photograph of Tom.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
How's it going, everyone? It's Tim and Lance here. Have you ever wanted someone to read you creepy bedtime stories in the most velvety voice ever?
Well, you had me hooked at velvety, Tim. We are excited to share a podcast that is exactly that. It's called Nighty Night Bedtime Stories to Keep You Awake. And Tim, it's narrated by a friend of ours.
That's right. New York Times bestselling author and podcaster Rabia Chaudhry. Nighty Night is an anthology featuring classic horror stories this season and fictionalized true life stories in season one that are so creepy that you will realize reality is scarier than fiction.
And Tim, I know our favorite part of each episode is at the end when Rabia says, but wait, there's more to the story. And we get to hear those fascinating details about the author and the context of the tale. What's your favorite episode?
My favorite episode is The Tiny Hares from season one, which takes us on a harrowing journey when the narrator runs into a dangerous man in the woods. What about you?
Well, mine comes from the current season. It's called The Horla, in which we witness the protagonist spiral into a descent of madness. Tim, I feel like I'm constantly spiraling into a descent of madness, so I really relate to that one.
Well, I hear that. So dim your lights, get under a cozy blanket, and find and subscribe to Nighty Night wherever you get your podcasts.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Step into the hidden corridors of the past with Hometown History, where every episode uncovers the untold stories and secrets nestled in the streets and alleys of our own backyards. We bring history to life, revealing the extraordinary in the ordinary, from local legends to forgotten tales that shape the communities we know today. Tune into Hometown History and embark on a journey through time, right from where you are.
Do you find yourself captivated by the inexplicable, entranced by enigmas, and tantalized by the unknown? We are Shane and Josh Waters, brothers who will weave you through tales that have mystified us for years. From haunted hotels to inexplicable disappearances,
Our episodes offer you a panoramic view of the world's greatest mysteries, leaving no stone unturned, no clue unnoticed.
With a gripping narrative, we invite you to join us on a journey into realms of the unexplained.
We're unraveling the mysteries that have perplexed humanity for ages.
So, armchair detectives, curious minds, and seekers of the strange, it's time to put on your headphones and dim the lights.
Dive into the uncanny world of the Mystery Inc. podcast and prepare for a journey into the unknown that you'll never forget. And remember, some mysteries are better left unsolved, but not unexplored.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program. But then about 2 years later, pretty much out of the Pacific blue, Dave emailed me a photo of Tom. And what a sight. To be honest, to me, he kind of looked like me at that age. And Dave finally had a photograph of Thomas Polleri to show his mom. I asked Dave what it meant to him.
Oh, I mean, it's like any other time you put a name to the face. It doesn't mean a lot because you're no longer a statistic. It becomes more personal. You know, even the Vietnam Wall, you can see the names on there, and that brings it to another level. That's the only memorial that has the names. I'm often asked at the World War II Memorial, you know, where the names are, but there are no names. There are gold stars. There's a gold star wall, and each gold star on that wall represents 100 people that died during the war. But it's not personal because you don't know the names. They're not listed out in the memorial, but to get his face, just to see the person's eyes, you can kind of empathize a little bit with the family because now you know what they're used to seeing and could no longer see again. So it's very deep and very personal.
And this is right about the time that I started wondering why and how Dave and his mom became interested in Thomas Polleri. Dave said Tom is kind of a guardian angel to his mom. And it was clear from our prior phone call that Dave's mom had a connection with Tom. Dave introduced me to his mother, Judy Knopp.
I come from a military family. I grew up and went to high school, always had this interest in World War II history. My huge interest in it started with William Barch's article in the September 1997, Crucial Battle Ignored. It really was a crucial battle because without what those folks did, especially your great uncle, people just did not realize his impact on keeping Henderson Field in American hands. And this is not to shortchange anything that the Raiders did on Edson Field, but there was an open flank, a wicked open flank on that right-hand side. And if the Japanese had realized it, we might have lost. In fact, we probably would have lost Guadalcanal and Australia. Huge.
Wow. So, yeah, that one battle and what Tom did seem to have sort of alerted his entire battalion to the Japanese. Is that how you understand it?
Yes. On the 12th of September 1942, Kawaguchi attacked, and Red Edson knew that they were going to come back. And so they were getting ready up on top of the ridge. But K31, which was where lots in my head, I call him Buddy. So if I call him Buddy, that's just because I'm used to that. Buddy was over there and he was with a weapons platoon. Joe Terzi was in charge of that. Terzi went and he said, I think we should have a listening post. There had been another one up the day before. The orders that were given by Joe Terzi, Lieutenant Terzi, scatter. And they were in thick jungle. Tom could have scattered. He did not. He stood his ground with a submachine gun and he blasted them to pieces and losing his life. Tom stood his ground. He stood his ground. He could have scattered. And what he did was he tied up the members of the Kuma Battalion because they were so mad because they thought they had run into the main line of the Marines. They didn't realize it was their listening post because of the fight they put up. What they did for quite some time was go up and down the Tenaru River. Now, of course, Tom, by that time, had lost his life. But the other ones had gotten into the Tenaru River, and there are banyan trees with huge, giant trunks, and the Japanese were going up and down both sides of the river, yelling and screaming and firing into the water. And so it held them up. That gave the rest of the three platoons that were strung out there from Iron Bottom Sound to the 350 yards of nothingness, single file, that gave them a chance to put up machine gun emplacements on either side of the overland trail.
Judy felt so connected to Tom that she wanted to help memorialize him further.
My son flew a American flag over the Capitol in honor of Tom and gave me the flag in a case for my birthday. And then for Christmas one year, he gave me all Tom's records, everything. And I had the picture of him from when he first signed up in January of 1942. So I knew him.
Wow. So how do you feel so connected to him?
That's what I'll tell you and not on the podcast. That is a story and a half. Yes, I'll tell you next summer. Yes, you
can... Be prepared, Tim.
Be prepared. That's my husband.
And prepared, I think I am. Do you have this type of connection with other veterans?
No. He's one of a kind. I'll tell you, and you can find that out why.
Judy and Dave want to come up to Boston to see Polaris Square and to meet with us. I can't wait.
When I got all the letters that your great-grandmother had written and the heartache, and I think she really died of a broken heart. And she just wouldn't accept that he was gone because she had no body.
And I wondered if Judy thought there was any chance to locate Tom after all these years.
They said he's unrecoverable, but you know what I said? I said, Angelina, I'm going to give it a shot. If I can find all this stuff, maybe I can find where he's at. And I think I know. I looked at all the reports in 46 and 49, where they went over there. A lot of that deep jungle has been cut down. It's farms. Now, Tom was found and buried in the field. There was a sketch of the grave, but all that's been lost. But they went in Point Cruz. That's not the right location where this place was. So they're looking in the wrong place. They found some people and they found their families. It's a long, laborious process. But I would just like, before I leave this earth, I'd just like to see him returned home. That's all.
You and me both, Judy. I know enough by now, after covering dozens of missing persons cases, that I've got to hold out hope. And I do. I just imagine being part of the process of bringing Thomas back to Cambridge, and I get emotional. I think about the pain that Angelina and Honey felt and how good it would feel to help. Even though everyone who knew Tom has passed away, would it count as closure? I don't know. Is there any such thing? Knowing that Dave's mom has a photo of Tom is some form of emotional closure, I have to admit. Hearing about their connection makes me happy. Tom did make a difference, and he continues to today. Then, as I was talking to my dad about producing this very episode, he found some unlabeled Hi-8 tapes that he decided to get digitized. And guess what was on it? The ceremony for the Silver Star for Tom Polaris back in 2000. I have some vague memories of being there back then, and I asked my father what he remembered.
Boy, I'll tell you, I was absolutely floored by the amount of accolades in the newspaper articles. Thomas Polaris was an absolute hero.
And were those stories that you had heard before that?
No. The only thing I knew was that in Cambridge, near Leechmere Station, across the street from Leechmere Station, was Thomas Polaris Square. That's the only thing I knew about Thomas. And I thought, well, you know, he probably did some pretty good things in the war. I had no idea when everything came to light at that dedication and when he was given a medal at that ceremony. We had no idea that. Well, I think your papa, my dad, probably knew some of it, but I don't even think they knew all of it.
Remember the passage from the book read earlier by my friend, voice actor Larry Butler? Well, my grandfather located Leo McDermott, and they corresponded back and forth. And Leo's letter to my grandfather was read at this dedication. The audio's okay. There is a little bit of a hum, though, so I will take over reading at some point.
This letter was written in 1997 to Corporal Polaris' brother, Frank. Frank had been seeking information regarding this battle, which I can honestly say went pretty much overlooked by our historians. Leo wrote to Frank, My name is Leo McDermott. I just finished reading in the Old Green News your questions about your brother Tom. Tom and I met sometime in February of 1942 when the 1st Marine Division was being formed. We were assigned to the weapons platoon of K Company, 3rd Marine Battalion.
Tom was a gunner in the machine gun section. I was an assistant gunner, an air-cool 30-caliber machine gun. We became good friends immediately, and I considered Tom as my best buddy. We were close. This is what happened the night Tom died. K Company sat up on the western edge of the large field, barbed wire strung about 50 to 75 yards to our front. Listening posts were sent out each evening inside the barbed wire. One night, a squad from one of the rifle platoons came back and said they heard the Japanese. Our platoon leaders, Lieutenant Joe Terzi, said he would take an all-volunteer listening post group out the next evening. Five of us went out with Lieutenant Terzi, Lawrence, Jabo, Mixter, Tom, and me. We did not stay inside the wire. We set up about 100 yards outside the wire. Sometime during the night, we heard a clanking noise. Then we could see the Japanese all lined against the sky. They were between us and our lines. Our listening post became an ambush post as we opened fire on the Japanese. All hell broke loose and our listening post became every man for himself. We had ambushed a Japanese battalion getting ready to assault our line. Lieutenant Terzi and I wound up in a creek behind us and spent all night in water up to our necks. We managed to make it back to our line the next morning. One man made it back that night, Lawrence. Mixter didn't return for 4 days. Jabo was picked up by I Company and made it to Walk Point. Tom was the only one who didn't make it. This all happened on the night of September 13th. Lieutenant Terzi and I were sent to a field hospital with our wounds, and when I came back to the company, they told me that Tom had been found on the 17th of September. I believe I'm the sole survivor of that lookout post. Terzi was KIA'd on Cape Gloucester. Again, I was by his side. Mixter was killed in action on Guam. Tom died a hero, Francis, because the firefight alerted K Company to a sure victory for the Japanese against Henderson Field. Sincerely, Leo McDermott, December 5th. And this next letter was written to my great-grandmother, Angelina, and it was written by Lieutenant Joe Terzi, who was also with Tom the night he died.
Dated April 23, 1943. Dear Mrs. Polari, I will do my best to tell you all I know about Tom. There comes a time in our mere mortal lives when words become hollow, meaningless sounds.
Meaningless sounds, incapable of expressing our true feelings. Such is the case now. I'm not writing this, not for myself, but for all of Tom's buddies and officers, all who knew him, had nothing but admiration for his fearlessness and for those qualities which made him a man in the fullest sense of the word. I could go on and enumerating his splendid attributes, but I know that you, his mother, need not be told what a good boy he was. We, his comrades in arms, can do little more than offer our most heartfelt condolences. I personally feel satisfied that Tom is in a better place than this world of turmoil and strife. Tom often confided in me, and his prime consideration was for you, his mother. He would be unhappy if he knew you were mourning. So please remember that, and bear your sorrow with courage and pride for so gallant a son, and someday in the hereafter, you will be united in the blissful realms of heaven. Tom, though he went quickly and didn't suffer, died, and buried a hero in the eyes of his commanding officer and fellow Marines. His memory will live with us forever, and we shall never forget him in our prayers. Again, let me offer our sincere condolences. May God bless you both. Keep your faith forever. Yours in sympathy, Joseph A. Terzi. P.S. If the occasion should present itself, you can rest assured that I will pay you a visit at your home. Tom was one of my best men, and you may well feel proud of his heroic death. Regrettably, Lieutenant Terzi was killed in action at Cape Gloucester shortly after writing this. I just want to say I love that Judy and Dave feel this connection with Tom Polari. I just love it. It warms my heart. He was a hero. And here we are now in the holiday season, and I can't help thinking about Tom and family ghosts and Angelina and Honey and my grandfather, Frank Polari. I don't exactly know what Judy's connection is with Tom and my family, but I can wait in finding out. I know that. And I just love that they brought me and my family closer to Tom and all their hard work has led me to put this episode out and to try and share Tom's story as far as I possibly can. So thank you, Judy, and thank you, Dave, and thank you to Frank Polleri, my father and my grandfather, and step-grandmother Sandy Polleri. Thanks to Sarah Sheckles, who lent her fabulous voice, and my friend G. Larry Butler for lending his voice for Leo McDermott. Larry's a veteran himself. And before we go, I just want to share one last story that Dave told me about his work with veterans.
I'll give you a quick Marine story. Maybe it'll put you in the mind of maybe how Thomas would be known. We had a few World War II Marines on one of the buses with us on a particular trip. They were Iwo Jima veterans. This veteran was with his guardian, and he was in a wheelchair. He couldn't walk very well, and he couldn't stand up very well. He was in his 90s. You can either take these steps up to it, or there's a ramp that kind of goes around to wheel a wheelchair up to it. So he got the veteran in the wheelchair and started heading up, and the veteran told him to stop. He wanted to get out and walk up to the memorial, but he really couldn't. He said, "I landed on this beach. I'm not going to get wheeled up to this memorial." Two guardians got him by the arms, and they slowly walked him up to that memorial. And to see that is just amazing. He didn't want to be an old man being at that memorial. So he didn't want to go in the wheelchair. And he had other guys on his mind too, I'm sure. So that's just how some of the Marines are.
This episode was written and produced by me, Tim Polleri. It's a story many years in the making, and it's not over yet. Please follow us on social media, and if you'd like to contact me directly, you can email tim@crawlspacepodcast.com. Thanks a lot for listening.
Looking to make more sustainable choices, but making your own shoes out of natural materials could pose a few challenges. The twigs and leaves in your yard aren't exactly comfortable, and while mud does perfectly contour the feet, it doesn't score high on the durability front. But thanks to Allbirds, you can skip all the backyard experimentation. At the Allbirds Innovation Lab, they're doing all the sciencey stuff like research and testing to create shoes from natural, sustainable materials. And their innovative processes mean using less of the bad stuff and more of the good while making shoes unlike any other. Like the Plant Pacer, made with 100% plastic-free plant leather. The Tree Dasher, a running shoe made from eucalyptus tree fiber. And from sugarcane, they've made the Superlight, their lightest shoe ever by weight and carbon footprint. It's not rocket science, it's shoe science. Allbirds is making shoes better than natural. They're supernatural. Find your perfect pair at allbirds.com today. That's ALLBIRDS.com.